Well, it looks like there was a wave that happened on Tuesday, but it kind of looks like it has the shape of President Trump's hair. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
I almost laughed out loud when you did that because, you know, I never know what you're going to say up front. What exactly shape is President Trump's hair?
Well, he's got a nice big wave in it, that's for sure. And that wave just got a little bigger after Tuesday night, Chuck. I mean, we're recording this on Wednesday of the day after the great supposed blue wave that was supposed to sweep across specifically Ohio and then in other parts of the country as well, that would usher in this renaissance for the Democratic Party and specifically for progressives. That they were going to show how much momentum they were going to have coming into the November elections, which are the midterm elections for a first-term president. Always very important to show how that president's agenda is being received, how the Congress is showing whether or not they're working with a president or working against a president. And we have both those, depending on, you know, and in this cycle, it should be showing working with, because you have a Republican president and your Republican-controlled House and Senate, so you should be seeing a lot of working with a president in those respects. And when you had Barack Obama and the Republicans held the House and for part of the time the Senate, how much they were working to stand against that president's agenda. Because we all know that it isn't about policy, it's about politics. It's about the R or the D behind your name and who has more of those that they can count noses with in both of those chambers and ultimately in the executive office. So it was actually it's not a night that you can make any kind of major claim to absolute and total no holds barred, no quarter kind of victory for either party. It was actually, as we're starting to see, and again, we're recording this on Wednesday, we won't even know completely for sure when this program airs on Saturday, as it does, Chuck, because especially in Ohio, in the race that was happening Tuesday night, which was a special election, to fill the remaining months of the term of now retired Congressman Pat Tiberi from the 12th Ohio Congressional District, which has about parts of seven counties in it. I mean, it's a big district. There's a little bit of the northern part of Franklin County in it, all of Delaware, Knox, some of Muskingum, some of, I think, Richland County. There's a small part like in Mansfield area. So that's all in it. It's a big district. It is a big spiraling district, and of course they had a fairly significant primary, and we talked about that, and you and I both backed a different candidate than the one who came out of the Republican primary for this seat, but Troy Balderson was the Republican nominee going into this special election against Danny O'Connor, who's the Franklin County auditor, I believe.
Yeah, he's the recorder. No,
recorder.
He's the recorder, yeah. Recorder.
I always get that wrong, and then I remember Clarence Mingo is the auditor, so... There we go. So that was the matchup, and O'Connor was supposedly raising more money than Balderson, was starting with a bigger base because he's in Franklin County. And Franklin County, that little sliver of Franklin County in the 12th Congressional District, Chuck, represents one-third of the votes.
Well,
in that district.
Let me tell you about that district. I used to live in that part of the district. When I moved from Westerville to Newark, I moved from the 12th Congressional District to the 12th Congressional District. That part of Westerville is overwhelmingly Republican.
Well, that's not how the numbers came out from the early tally coming out of Franklin County, because Danny O'Connor won the Franklin County portion of the district. He garnered, I believe it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 42,000 votes against Troy Balderson's 24 or 25,000. So it was a pretty big thump in Franklin County for the Democrats.
Yeah.
Which isn't surprising because Franklin County has been trending Democrat now for the last, close to 12 years.
I'm going to bring up it as something, though, that I know we'll want to talk about a little later, but that's turnout.
Oh, absolutely. We got to talk about let's hold on to that for a minute because we do want to bring that up. But, you know, we're going to look at this, but, you know, the whole point is that, again, there are seven counties in the Franklin County portion of the district, even though it's a small sliver geographically, is significant in the number of votes. Because, again, a third of the congressional district, and a congressional district, Chuck, is usually somewhere in the neighborhood of, roughly 600,000 people. People in the district from the census. That's kind of, you know, with congressional districts, we have 435 congressional districts across the country, and they're roughly broken up by, you know, population number. And in the 12th, roughly 600,000, you know, make up a congressional district. A third of those, about approximately 200,000 potential voters, or people, excuse me, it isn't just voters, it's people, and that counts elderly and young,
right,
and those who are, you know, disqualified from voting for whatever reasons or other. But there are about 200,000 just in that little sliver of Franklin County. Now, when you see that 60-plus thousand, close to 70,000 actually cast a ballot in Franklin County of those 600, so you're looking at less than 10% turnout. But the turnout isn't based on how many people live there. They're based on how many registered voters.
Exactly.
That's when the numbers start paring down. Then you start seeing these 30%+, 40% turnout. You know, it's like, well, yeah, turnout of people who actually took the time and bothered to go register to vote and actually have a legitimate voting position. And, of course, that brings up some things we've been talking about in the past with the whole idea of needing to purge the voter rolls and a Secretary of State who refused to do so after winning a Supreme Court decision because this special election was happening. And although probably could have made the call to say, well, we won't purge the rolls in the 12th congressional district, but we'll purge, you know, we'll start cleaning them up around the rest of the state prior to the November election. That Secretary of State, one John Houston, who's running as lieutenant governor candidate for Mike DeWine, chose to say that they're not going to touch the voter rolls at all until after November. Now, I don't necessarily see that as a smart move. I do understand they were kind of bound by law that because we were within 90 days of this special election, they at that time couldn't touch the voter rolls on the 12th and wouldn't have been able to touch them, I believe, going into November because of the date of this special election. I believe it falls like on the 90th day prior to the November election. And so, you know, and if you can't change a voter's
his registration.
If you can't question or clean them off the rolls within 90 days of an election, you couldn't do it for this election, and then you couldn't do it for November in this district. But this was the only race that was happening in August.
Ohio, exactly.
Because we have our primaries in May. So the Secretary of State could have basically been going to the other 15 congressional districts, and which is 90%+ of the state, and getting the voter rolls cleaned up in time for the November midterm elections. But he chose not to do so. I think it was a bad move. I think it was strategically. I understand they're trying not to make an issue and be beat up in the press. And even though they do have a Supreme Court ruling now behind them saying that, yes, that it's legitimate for them to do it, they didn't want to create an issue because, well, Secretary of State is now running for lieutenant governor and didn't want to create an issue for their campaign opponents to try to capitalize on. I'm not sure that that's a winning strategy, and I believe it may have not have been a winning strategy, and part of it would be what we're looking at with this 12th congressional district. I mean, we don't know right now, Chuck, how many votes were cast in this district that were not legitimate. We do know that there are approximately 8,000 provisional and absentee ballots yet to be counted. 8,400 absentee provisional ballots and provisional ballots that did not get counted. okay?
Yep.
According to the Secretary of State's office, they basically, it is those you cannot count until 11 days after the election. So that was August the 7th. So we won't know until, well, maybe August the 18th or after whether or not this particular seat was actually won by what appears to be the presumptive winner, Troy Balderson, for the Republicans, who basically won with what looks to be like a 1,766 vote lead.
It's about, I was going to say, it's around, it's between 1,500 and 2,000 votes is what it looked like to me.
I think the numbers, the rough numbers as reported by the Secretary of State so far are Balderson received 101,566 votes and Danny O'Connor received 99,800 votes. Now, okay, so you've got, that's 200,000 votes cast, Chuck. So basically, a third of all the people in that congressional district went to the polls. Okay?
Yeah.
That's what it looks like. But that 8,400 more, 9,000 more had to cast what's considered a provisional ballot. And Chuck, I know you got some background on this. Do you understand why someone has to cast the provisional ballot?
Yeah, because they went to a polling place and their registration information was not there.
Exactly, and that could be due to a number of factors. It could be due to the fact that they moved and forgot to update their registration, their address, and they moved within the district, or they moved into the district and forgot to update their address. But they lived there, and they've lived there long enough, or they've just moved within the district, that they are technically qualified to be a voter in that district, but because their name doesn't show up on the voting rolls in that precinct or in that district, and this could even be down at the precinct level, if the folks that were manning the polls on Tuesday, you know, they get and you come up and you say, hey, I'm Joe Smith and da 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 da, and they look and they don't have a Joe Smith in there, and so, you know, they ask a couple of questions, and I ran into this in the spring. Because my son, who turned 18 last year and who was getting ready to turn 19 a couple of weeks after the vote, after the spring primaries, and who had voted last fall in November, in 2017 in November for a number of things, went in to cast a ballot. And my son is one of these people who he's not in any hurry to get a driver's license.
Yeah.
he doesn't see the necessity of it since he has a business which is all tech-based, and he works on it, and he's got his own setup and his own office and everything else, and he doesn't have to go anywhere. And so he really is just like, it's just something, it's a distraction I don't need right now. And I honestly don't have any place I want to go or need to go. If I need to go somewhere, you guys, I'll go with you, you know? And I'm like, fine, you know, I don't mind that because unlike some parents who want to get their kids in a car and out of the house as soon as possible, I'm okay with them not being out on these highways with people who may be impaired with alcohol, drugs, you know, distracted driving. The list goes on.
You guys don't have that. Yeah, you guys don't have that in Gallia County, do you?
I'm endorsing the let's wait on that decision to get behind the wheel of a car.
You guys don't have that in Gallia County, do you?
Oh, no, not at all. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and did I tell you the one about the guy who basically took his pickup truck and ran it off the road in the middle of the night, took out my mailbox on the far side of the road, came across lanes over a hill, ran down into the ditch at the edge of my property, and then slammed into the culvert that is my mom and dad's driveway, throwing everything in the back of his pickup truck all over my parents' yard, which took us 3 days to pick up, including broken glass and everything else. And he got out of the truck and ran off somewhere. They couldn't find him. He'd gone to a friend's house that he knew of in the area. He was totally rocked off his socks
of course.
And drugs and alcohol.
Yeah, of course.
He did a significant swath of damage. And if anybody or any vehicle had been out there, they would have been in jeopardy.
If you want to have a great deal of entertainment, there's an app you can get for your phone, and it's a scanner something. Yeah, I mean, basically, it basically gives you access to an online scanner. Scanner Radio, and put in Licking County Fire and Safety. If you really are shy of entertainment on a Friday night, turn that on about 7 o'clock. And, wow, all I can tell you is you will hear things that you never expected to hear in your entire life. Now, some of it's funny. Some of it's tragic. You know, there's somebody laying in the Chipotle parking lot on North 21st Street with a needle sticking out of their arm in the parking lot, you know. And they go up and give them Anarcan and you know, get them back to some so they can transport them to the hospital and treat them, and they can be back at it again in a couple weeks. Newark is a place where that kind of thing goes on, unfortunately, fairly regularly. One of the reasons I'm here, and one of the reasons is that hopefully I can be an aid to the community and help bring an end to that kind of thing. Through the auspices of through the activity of the Holy Spirit and the Savior Jesus Christ, but it's a long uphill climb. Okay, sorry, I segued, but
that's fine, because we were talking about the whole idea of provisional ballots. When my son came in and he didn't have a driver's license, you know, he basically, we were looking at him and like, no, he's got his Selective Service registration card, which is a federally issued document, which is significantly allowable
Absolutely.
For voting purposes.
Absolutely.
You know, if you sign up for Selective Service, then you're allowed to use that as identification for voting. And they were talking about giving him a provisional ballot. Of course, we showed them in the rules where, no, this is a legitimate form of ID. He's verified his identification. He signed the book and give him his ballot. You know, let him vote here, not provisional. But in the 12th, 8,400 provisional ballots. John.
That's a huge number out of 200,000 cast. That's 4%.
Okay, now think about this. Franklin County is a third of the district, and it's a little sliver. Like I said, you know, it doesn't even take up probably an eighth of the county, of the whole county of Franklin County in that congressional district. It maybe not even take up a tenth. Richland County, the Mansfield area, it's maybe a fourth of the county. Everything else pretty much is the entire county. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Every other county, Delaware County, you know, on the Muskingum, you know, where Troy Balderson was from, Muskingum, and those were all whole counties in the district. So if you lived in the county, guess what? You lived in the congressional district. Now, if you moved within the county, you may have run into the issue that you forgot to update your voter ID. But of 200,000 or so votes cast,
that's a big number.
That's basically 4%.
That's what, yeah.
It's 4%. Yeah, you were right. 4%. 4%+ of the people turning out to vote didn't vote where they were supposed to, or didn't have the right form of ID,
or weren't registered
could
at all.
Could verify that they were a registered voter.
Exactly.
That's scary. I mean, that right there. I mean, I saw that number, Chuck, and I'm sitting there like, are you kidding me? But anyhow, again,
that smells like fraud. I'll be quite honest. That kind of number smells like people just, it doesn't matter if you're registered or not, go vote.
Now, it does raise a question, because number one, usually when, you know, you're getting to the point where you're losing by more than the margin of error, and the margin of error is 0.5%, a half a percent, or not margin of error, excuse me, automatic recount.
Right.
If the difference between candidates is between the two candidates in a head-to-head race is less than a half a percent between them, it triggers an automatic recount of the votes, right?
Yep.
And we know in the primary there was less than half a percent, or no, excuse me, there was just over half a percent separating Troy Balderson from the second place finisher, Melanie Linehan. Now, Linehan took the other option. She paid for a recount in certain counties because she didn't like how the numbers were showing up. Troy Balderson won 78% of the primary ballots in Muskingum, in his home county of Muskingum, in that primary, which is the first time he's ever won that many votes in that.
Yeah, exactly. It smelled funny.
And it smelled, and there were some issues, and there's been a case filed with the Ohio Supreme Court by the Linehan campaign over the question of whether or not there was tampering with the ballots by officials in Muskingum County. Now we have 8,400 more absentee ballots, and so what is the Democrat who just was on the short end of that vote, and it was 0.9% lead, okay? So at the end of the night, Balderson had 50.2% of the vote to O'Connor's 49.3% of the vote. Now, normally, a candidate who realized, oh, gosh, you know, okay, maybe it's time for me to, you know, call up him and congratulate him on his victory, et cetera, and concede a race. First thing O'Connor did was, we're not conceding anything. We're going to stay into it because they're looking for those provisional votes that haven't been counted to break their way. Now, in order for him to win, they need more than 60% of those votes to break their way. Basically, over 5,000 of the 8,400 absentee and provisional ballots that are not counted yet would have to be filed for O'Connor in order for him to win this seat.
Yeah.
If I'm doing the math as a campaign and knowing that it's expensive, et cetera, and knowing full well I am still running, because that's the other little caveat with this particular race, Chuck, and I think part of the reason why so many people were looking at this as a quote-unquote bellwether is that these same two individuals, Troy Balderson for the Republicans, Danny O'Connor for the Democrats, are running head-to-head against each other in November, just 90 days from now, to basically be the congressman for the 12th Congressional District starting in January when the new Congress convenes for a full term. See, right now they're just running to fill out the last 5 months or whatever it is now. Four months.
No, because you figure December, they're basically adjourned.
Yeah, so basically it's like 3 months of active duty to fill out the rest of Pat T. Barry's term. Now, I get it in one sense. If you concede now, then it quells momentum, et cetera. So there are a lot of factors that are playing into why O'Connor didn't get out. But if I'm sitting there and I'm looking at it and I need to pull over 5,000 of 8,000 ballots that have been cast, and I don't know how many of them are from which counties, knowing full well that I did a great in Franklin County, but also knowing the reason why I did great was Franklin County's early voting was big. You know, he had a big lead leading into it. I mean, you and I talked offline.
We've talked about this, yeah.
There was this whole idea about how, you know, O'Connor was leading Balderson 64-36%, and then Saturday happened. And we're going to talk about what happened Saturday in just a minute, because that's a whole other kettle of fish that came up. But right now, in the aftermath of this election, O'Connor's banking on at least, and the number is 5,083 of those 8,400 ballots have to be cast for him. He's banking on that. Wonder why, Chuck.
Yeah, exactly.
We just, you don't even have to say it.
No.
It's just right there in front of you.
Smellerino, baby.
Or, you know, he needs to have at least 60% of 4%. So 2.4%, I guess, is what he's looking for. He needs that 2.4% of more bump in order to get up over the
He needs
the hump,
to get here's really. The problem. He needs to get over 60% of the absentees.
Over 60% of the absentees.
Or not, I'm sorry, of the provisionals. Which may happen if this is a voter fraud situation, and I don't know how they work a provisional. If you walk in and vote and you're not registered anywhere, I'm assuming on a provisional they can just toss your ballot.
Well, they can toss it because what they have to do, and this is the Secretary of State, they have to take that ballot that was cast and the information that was provided on, and they have to check versus their system. And they have to figure out if, A, the person has ever registered to vote, and if so, B, was that registration done and filed with a county or with a county board of elections or with the Secretary of State at least 30 days prior to the election, because that's the cutoff for registration.
Right.
Now, what happens is that, you know, and some of these, since we now have what's basically all but a motor voter law, you can register and vote the same day up to a certain point. Remember, they were fixing that thing, but I'm not sure they ever quite got that fixed.
No, where the golden
early voting started before the cutoff for registration.
Yeah.
So you could register and vote the same day.
Was it Golden Week? Wasn't that what that was called?
Yeah, they called it Golden Week, and the Dems took full advantage of it because they realized that it was a Republican Republican legislation that got us Golden Week because somebody couldn't do math. They were so excited about being in control of elections that they couldn't do basic math and figure out that 35 days and 30 days left you with a five-day window. So what we got is, so all that's off the table, but the Secretary of State would have to verify that and figure out, do they have a registration that's pending that hasn't been put into the system yet that was filed, you know, in the legal time frame, 30 days or more prior to the election, and reflects this voter's information and the fact that they live and can vote in the 12th congressional district. So that's the reason why the Secretary of State has 11 days after the election to finish counting provisionals, because it does take some work.
Yeah.
But, you know, right now, it's cautiously optimistic that Troy Balderson is going to go to D.C. sometime in the next 3 weeks. You know, I'm sure in 11 days when they come out and he's still got a lead, that's it. He's going to go to D.C. He'll be sworn in. And he'll take Pat Seabury's place in Congress. Now, I don't know and doubt very seriously if he gets Pat Seabury's committee assignments because
Pat had been there
for a while and he was on a number of powerful committees. And Troy's not going to be just granted the, you know, open slot on the
right. Just because you're in Ohio 12, yeah, that's not attached to Ohio 12. It's you'll end up on the you know, Weights and Measures Committee and that kind of junk at first.
Yeah. But here's the other thing, Chuck, and this is bringing up what we were talking about earlier, that if the early vote, the absentee filing of votes and the early voting period, which closes before the election, Danny O'Connor was winning.
Yes.
Because a lot of people, I think, in Franklin, a lot of the Democrats decided they were going to go bank and vote early.
There's this thing floating around, and you and I have discussed it, and I still, you've explained it to me, and I still really don't get it. The early vote tells the tale. You know, the people who go out and do a ballot before the general. I've done it once or twice. I did it once because I was going to be out of town during the general, so I voted absentee. I went down, and in those days, you could go down to the Franklin County Board of Elections and cast a regular old ballot on a machine, and that's what I did because I was going to be out of town on the general election date. Other times, I've seen people who get the paper ballot and all that stuff. But there's some kind of an idea out there that if you can really motivate people to go out and vote early, then you're going to win the election. And I'm like, I don't think so. I understand what you're trying to do. You're trying to get a thing with gin up the excitement, get them to do it right now while they're thinking about it, you know, blah, 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 blah. But I'm not buying it. Now, I'm going to let you take over and tell me why I'm wrong.
Okay, well, I'm not sure I'll tell you why you're wrong, but what you had was this went out, and actually it was, and this was a, and there was a tweet last night from the president, from Donald Trump. Now, kind of backstopping that, Donald Trump came to Ohio on Saturday evening, to campaign for Troy Balderson because early voting numbers were showing that he had some trouble. He was down in the early voting 64-36. That means that 64% of the absentee ballots that had been cast, the early ballots that had been cast, were breaking to Danny O'Connor. That is not a good trend. As a matter of fact, that's a big swamp of problems if you're on the 36 end, because even though early voting, and I don't know exactly what percentage of the ballot was early voting, but if provisionals were about 4%, I'm guessing that the early vote may have broken somewhere in the neighborhood of, I don't know, 25%?
No, you want to know what the margin was?
Well, no, I know, not the margin.
Not the margin.
I'm saying the percentage of the total votes that were cast in the election, how many of them were cast early as absentee or provisionals. It could have been as high as 25% of the total vote, or maybe a little bit more. It could have been 30%. So if you're taking, say, let's say a third of the votes and you're losing 64-36, you got an awful lot to make up in the other two thirds of the voting that are going to that's going to happen on election day, in order to pull out a win. People were wringing their hands over this, who are Politico types, especially Republicans. And honestly, what it got down to is that's part of the reason why Donald Trump personally burned some capital and flew into Ohio and did a big rally in Delaware for Troy Balderson. Now, Balderson, after winning, has thanked Trump profusely for it. And, of course, Trump last night tweets out, he goes, "When I decided to go to Ohio for Troy Balderson, he was down in early voting 64-36. That was not good. After my speech on Saturday night, there was a big turn for the better. Now, Troy wins a great victory during a very tough time of the year for voting. He will win big in November." Now, Trump's hit on a couple of truths here. It is a tough time of the year. It's August. It's early August. Most people aren't paying any attention to elections and voting. Now, of course, they ginned this up, and there were like dozens and dozens of mailers and television and everything else, so you couldn't escape the fact that there was a vote to be cast in the 12th Congressional District. And Trump may be right about the November race, because everybody was looking at this particular election, this fight in Ohio, as the bellwether of whether or not the Dems were going to have enough momentum in order to swing and possibly take over the House in November from the Republicans in Congress. So I think Trump's hitting on a couple of things. Was there a big turn after his speech on Saturday night? Well, it very well possibly could have happened, Chuck, because as you know, in that district, Donald Trump won big.
Oh, yeah.
That if you looked at the 12th Congressional District, Donald Trump won against Hillary Clinton pretty big in that district. Troy Balderson didn't win nearly as big as Donald Trump did in 2016. But the reason why he may have still won could have been because Trump came in and energized his base, who were not, by and large, Troy Balderson supporters in the primary. Many of them were voting and working for Melanie Linehan and for a couple of other candidates. They weren't working for what we consider to be the establishment candidates, which Troy Balderson completely fits that role, no matter how many palm cards, mailers, and television ads ran talking about how conservative he was. He's not. He's basically an establishment Republican in the mold of a John Kasich and a Pat Tiberi.
Which is why the Ohio Republican Party basically pulled out all the stops and actually illegally aided Balderson during the primary race.
Well, that's a possibility.
The fact is that the Ohio Republican Party poured money into the race in favor of Balderson and against Linehan. And the reason why? Because Balderson is a reliable vote for the GOP establishment.
Now, well, yes, there is that.
Sure. Now, I'll be quite honest. I held my nose and voted for him. I did not want to vote for him, but I looked at the alternatives, and I weighed the fact that Balderson has shown signs that he will follow the edict of, I believe it was, Everett Dirksen. Wasn't it Senator Edward Dirksen who said, "When we feel the heat, we see the light"?
Yep.
Balderson is a guy who, when he feels the heat of electoral unhappiness, can be made to see the light. That's another reason why I pulled the cord, because we can apply enough pressure to him to have him do things like vote for the wall. Now, he basically came out and said right up front that he was going to be on board with the Trump agenda. We'll see. I have grave doubts.
He definitely has to say he'll have to be on board with the Trump agenda between now and November.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. Now, what happens when he gets elected? Who knows? Because, okay, I don't know. I don't remember if O'Connor won the nomination for the fall.
Yes, he did.
He did.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, because these two are going to be facing each other in November.
This is going to be a redo.
Both parts of the spring primary to face each other in August here for the filling the seat, and in November for taking the next seat.
So this is going to be a redo. The it will be very different in the fall. Everybody is pretty much acknowledging that this was a one-shot deal for this special election that was supposed to be a bellwether for the blue wave that was coming in November. As we've talked about before, Barry, it's really looking like the blue wave is turning into an ebb tide.
Well, it's so much so now before we talk about that, but you know, there were five elections that were going on across the country yesterday. You know, Ohio was the one that was sucking up all the air in the room. But there were five elections, and in all five of the elections, Donald Trump, the president, endorsed a candidate in those five races. All five won, Chuck. Now, there's one, a gubernatorial primary, that is still slightly up in the air because it's well within the margin of error until they start counting some absentee ballots. But it's looking like I said, that the only wave that has developed is a deeper wave in Trump's hairdo, because he's flipping it back more, saying, See, I told you. I can get these guys in here. They got to get on board the Trump train, and we can take them to the station. And he's right. In one sense, that's how Troy Balderson won, because he wasn't going to win with a bunch of establishment country club moderate Republicans voting in that district. That's not how that district's made. That district's more rural than it is anything. And those rural voters, Trump won that district by 11 points in 2016. Troy Balderson won it by 9/10 of a point.
Yeah.
Now, you saw some numbers, and this is a good time to talk about these. Some of the real breakdown numbers that I think are much more important talk about whether or not there's a blue wave, or if the blue wave was just a blue fantasy.
Well, essentially, you know, special elections, not that many people turn out. We all know that, you know, especially in August, for crying out loud. That's why school districts love to run levies as a special in August, which I'd love to see outlawed. But nonetheless, and cities do it too, to pass income tax things, because nobody shows up to vote. Who do they get out? They get out the people who are rah-rah for it. And this article in the Gateway Pundit says exactly that. Now, I misinterpreted it when I first read it, but the misinterpretation doesn't put me off all that much, because the headline says, Ohio special election. Democrat turnout 87% of 2016 total. GOP turnout only 40% of 2016 total. Okay. When I first read it, I said, oh, Democrats turned out at 87%. No, they came out for a special election in August at 87% of their 2016 total.
Right.
What does that mean?
That means that in a historic election where there was massive turnout, the Democrats still were able to push almost 90% of their voters back out to the polls.
Exactly.
In a special election. So you got to pay attention to that. That should be getting some people to set up and take some notice. But what else do you see? And of course, bodes, I think, as much for the Donald Trump effect as it does anything, Chuck. What was it on Troy Balderson's side, on the Republican side?
40%.
40% of the people who turned out in 2016, in a district that Trump won by 11 percentage points, only 40% of those people who came out to vote, the numbers, you're not the exact individuals, because there are some people who stayed home in 2016 too.
Yep.
But 40% of those people, or one in every 2.5 who voted in 2016, bothered to come out and pull a lever for Troy Balderson. Now, did Trump's appearance on Saturday make a difference? I think it did.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that 40% number may have been somewhere in the 20s, had not both the president and, I know, a number of Tea Party folks finally got behind it and said, we got to keep the Democrats from gaining momentum by taking this seat. And they came out and they voted. Not all of them did, though, and a lot of them probably stayed home, or I know the Green candidate got a few votes, but I'm sure he wouldn't have gotten it for most of the Tea Party folks. But the whole point is that the biggest takeaway, or I guess there's three takeaways, Chuck, from this, from those numbers, that political-minded people ought to be paying attention to is, number one, the Democrats still have enthusiasm, and they are able, even in a special election, to turn out voters. So they've got some, they've figured out the magic sauce in order to keep their voters engaged and get them to the polls. Something the Republicans ought to be thinking about, because, gee, if they could get 9 out of every 10 to the polls and we can only get 4 out of every 10 of ours, even though numerically there may be more registered Republicans in the 12th congressional district than Democrats, it isn't that big of a difference. This is a problem. It's a problem that if the Republicans / conservatives are going to not be inundated under in a blue wave, because it could still happen. Tsunamis sometimes come up out of nowhere when you hear a rumbling. That's the earthquake under the sea opening up and creating the wave that's about to come crashing down on your little island.
Can you say 2016?
Yeah, 2016 being the key point. That's the reason why we're pulling back to these numbers. The second piece of the advice that I would be giving to Republicans is that you need to get better candidates who more reflect the will of the electorate, and especially in a district where Trump won by 11 points, kind of, and maybe, maybe not, we'll find out when we hear how Linehan's case about the potential vote corruption and dirty tricks of the Muskingum County Republican Party and Muskingum County Board of Elections turns out, that finagling to get your establishment candidate in this environment may be what is causing the problem with, and may be fueling a blue wave. Because the only way a blue wave is really going to happen, Chuck, is if a lot of Republican conservatives just say, forget it. You know what? I'm not voting for the same old they've been sending to me.
Yeah. And see, that's a real concern here. There are a lot of Republicans sitting home, I'm guessing also in the 12th, because they were not happy with what happened in the primary.
Well, we know a lot of them did just from looking at the turnout numbers. I mean, whether it was the, we just didn't want to go out in August, or et cetera, or whether it was we just don't like the candidate, 40% of the 2016 Republican turnout, now again, that was a November election, 40% turned out for this August special election. 40% of those numbers, Chuck. Now, Trump won by 11 points, so that does bring the numbers a little closer together. And, of course, for Danny O'Connor, it means you lose by 1,766 votes right now, because there's enough, even with 40% turnout, there were enough Republicans to beat an 87% Democratic turnout in that district.
This article has an interesting graphic, and what they're trying to do is compare, they're trying to make a point by comparing the 2016 congressional election to this special. And it's an apples and oranges comparison. Here's what they're saying is that Pat Tiberi, who's the former incumbent in this district, got 67% of the vote in 2016, and Ed Albertson, the Democrat, was able to pull less than 30.
Okay, well, you're right. It's apples and oranges because, number one, in 2016, Pat Tiberi had been on the ballot in that congressional district four times.
Four times, yes.
Now, he was an incumbent had won his seat four times.
Yeah, is that right? Albertson
had no support from the Democratic Party, the DNCC, the Soroses of the world, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all who ponied up big money to Danny O'Connor. Danny O'Connor beat Troy Balderson in fundraising. He was raising more money.
Now, I've been looking at numbers. There was a third-party candidate in this race.
Yeah, a Green Party candidate, Joe Manchin or something like that. I can't remember.
Joe Manchin. He was Green
Manchin,
Party.
Yes.
He pulled next to nothing.
He pulled less than a percent. So,
yes.
So if you look at the numbers, you know, if you look at the percentage points, 50.2 to 49.3 means that he pulled 0.5%.
Yeah. And I looked at the numbers last night. I haven't looked at them this morning to see where they finally ended up. But even adding him back to O'Connor,
yeah,
wasn't enough.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't have been enough for O'Connor to win. But what it would have done, if all of Manchik's votes would have gone to O'Connor, it would have put the percentages in a position where an automatic recount would have happened.
Yes. Well, you know there's going to be a demand for a recount. You can't escape it when it's this close.
Yeah, and because the stakes are so high, if you win, you're automatically seated as a congressperson. You don't have to wait till January.
Right. Yep.
So again, but the third takeaway I have from this, Chuck, and I think that it's the biggest one, and that is the best tonic for the blue wave disease is President Trump. The same person who the establishment Republicans are blaming for the blue wave happening, I think, is the only solution to stopping a blue wave from engulfing them in November. But they're running away from it. As you saw on Saturday night, Trump comes to Delaware, stumps for Troy Balderson, brings him up, shakes his hand, says great things about him. Sunday morning, John Kasich, and you knew I had to bring him up.
Unfortunately.
John Kasich's on the news program saying how horrible it was that Trump came in and he should have stayed away because he's going to hurt Troy with suburban women. Now, of course, this close race, Kasich's going to go out there and thump his chest and say, see, I was right that Trump was hurting him. The suburban women were turned off by Donald Trump, and it almost cost Troy the seat. No, it didn't. The point that if Donald Trump had not come into Ohio on Saturday night, we would be saying, hello, Congressman O'Connor, on Wednesday morning. It wouldn't have been close, Chuck.
I tend to agree with you.
I think even Trump, in a Republican district, it wouldn't have been close, because if the Trump voters didn't warm up to Troy Balderson because the president basically said, hey, guys, we've got to get down on this, and we have got to
now
win this seat.
Here's why, I think. What county took Balderson from a slight deficit to a slight lead?
Delaware County.
Delaware County did it. Now, why did Trump show up? Did he really, you know...
Does he really like Troy Balderson and think he's going to be like a swamp drain? No.
No. Here's why he came. He needs the seat, and he knew that it's... look, the political realities are that anybody who knows politics knows that a special is a special case. A special election is a special case, and you have to do certain things. Where did he go? Did he come to Licking County? No. Why? Because Delaware County has a huge Republican base, and he knew, this shows the smarts of Donald Trump, he knew that if he could go to Delaware County and gin up a excitement to go to the polls on Tuesday rather than sit home like a lot of the district did, that Delaware could put Balderson over the top. What happened? Delaware put Balderson over the top.
Yep.
That's the bottom line.
And trust me, I know an awful lot of people in Delaware County, many of whom worked for Trump in 2016. If you asked them up until about 2 weeks ago how they felt about Troy Balderson, it would have been, shall we say, lukewarm at best. There weren't too many of them out there stumping, we got to get Troy in office. They were still stinging from what appears to be possibly a not completely above board win by Balderson against someone who they knew was 100% with them. But again, water under the bridge right now, because even if the Supreme Court comes out and says, yeah, there was tampering with that race, well, we've already had the intervening race, and so that pretty much makes it a moot point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sadly enough, it makes it a moot point. But if it hadn't, I'm going to say right now, and of course, Balderson gets out there and he thanks Trump and he thanks Pence, because Mike Pence did come in too a little bit earlier. The numbers didn't move that much in the early voting with Pence, but boy, when Donald Trump came in, we got some movement. But, you know, he spent an awful lot of time thanking two other people, Chuck. He thanked Pat Tiberi, the former congressman, for helping him to navigate and get through the process. And all of his help, which includes money. And he thanked the NRCC, the National Republican Campaign Committee chairman, Steve Stivers, who's also from Ohio. So basically, Troy is signaling to both Stivers and T-Berry, he's on the team.
He's on the team, yeah.
Even though he had to thank Trump and he had to thank Pence, he's still on the establishment team.
You notice who he didn't thank was John Kasich.
Because both of those guys are fully establishment Republicans.
Yeah.
Now, you and I both know the reason why, and there was another issue, we may have a little bit of time for this, but Saturday night in Delaware, Donald Trump did something that kind of surprised a lot of people. It certainly surprised the politicos of the establishment because this was the last thing they wanted to have happen. He's getting ready to talk, or he's talking, and he hears this chant from the audience about Jim Jordan being Speaker of the House, which we know, we've talked about this. Congressman Jordan has announced that he's running for the Speaker of the House when Paul Ryan steps down at the end of the year. It's a great thing. We've had a speaker here not too long ago in John Boehner before Paul Ryan. It would be great to have Jim Jordan from Ohio leading the House of Representatives in the second half of Trump's first term, because I think we'd get a lot more done, and I think you'd see a lot more benefit for the country that way. Problem is that the Republican establishment doesn't like Jim Jordan probably as little or less than they like Donald Trump. Because he's not a guy that can be bought. He's not a guy that'll play the game too much. He'll play it a little bit, but when push comes to shove, he's got a bright line he's not going to cross. They don't like that. So there's like a half a dozen names that are now floating out there and people trying to, you know, whether it's Kevin McCarthy or Steve Scalise or a host of people that the mainstream political media like Politico, The Hill, The Dispatch, others are throwing out there. They tried to injure Jordan's reputation with this whole thing with the Ohio State, you know, molestation deal with the wrestlers, just to find out that pretty much everybody and their brother, except for the two or three people who were making accusations, all backed Jim Jordan's character and ethics and integrity.
Yeah.
Boom. That one blew up in their face. So this time, big event. The president coming in, you'd think all the luminaries would be invited. And of course, Mike DeWine, and I don't know if Houston was with him, but I probably was. The governor's candidate and our attorney general was there. Jim Renacci, running for the U.S. Senate, was there. Of course, Balderson was there because that's who was being, you know, feted at that point. The one person that the Republican Party didn't even invite, much less, you know, wanted to acknowledge, was Jim Jordan. Problem was, Jordan just came and came as a part of the audience. He didn't ask for any special treatment. He was around talking to people and things, and all of a sudden, while Trump's up there, this big chant about Jim becoming Speaker of the House starts up. Trump looks up. He sees Jordan. He invites him up onto the stage.
I'm guessing that somebody got talked to. You want to know what happened after that? Why wasn't he invited up here? Why did I have to do it?
Well, the possibility, although maybe Trump just figures he's not getting in the middle of that. But, you know, the whole point is that, you know, you've got, this is a guy who's as popular as Donald Trump, if not more so, in Ohio. Jim Jordan is universally respected by the grassroots in the state of Ohio. I think I can say that unequivocally. For the Republican Party to, first of all, make this claim that, well, Troy Balderson didn't invite Trump, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, I'm sure he didn't because, frankly, his handlers wouldn't want Trump within 100 yards of him. But the point is probably Bob Poduchik, who's the RNC deputy chairman and Trump's campaign manager in Ohio, probably said, oh, no, you're bringing him in because the numbers are not looking good for Troy on early voting. Get him in here. So I'm guessing that's exactly what happened with that. So they don't want Jim Jordan around either. I mean, honestly, you took a look at it. What was the Dispatch, the paper of record, supposedly in Central Ohio, has basically just been running. Well, now the big thing is, well, Jim Jordan's lacking in fundraising against the other announced candidates. Yeah, well, maybe he's not trying to buy his way into the seat. Have Have you ever thought about that? That maybe he's done enough work behind the scenes with people that he's got the respect of a lot, and he's out there working to get people elected to support him. Now, one of the things that I'm still not seeing from a number of the Ohio delegation to Congress is they're getting behind Jim Jordan for a speaker run. I'm hoping to see that. I know I'm probably holding my breath until I'm turning blue in the face. I'm hoping to see that Balderson and others finally get on board and get behind Jim Jordan's run for speaker. You know, and that's what it takes. You know, if they think about it, they're not going to get any better opportunity to have an impact in Washington, D.C., than have gotten behind the individual who both is their fellow colleague from their home state and who is going to run the show in Congress with an eye to fixing problems. I mean, this is someone who, if you're not there just because you want to, like, grab a paycheck and have the accolades of having the word congressman in front of your name, but you're actually there to solve problems for the American people and to, you know, help your district and do the things that, we kind of expect our elected representatives to do for us, but hardly ever do. There's no greater opportunity because there's not a single other person on that list, McCarthy, Scalise, etc., who are going to work with you without expecting you to basically pony up to them and not really care about your state because they're from another state. Now, of course, I don't see Steve Stivers, who's the National Republican Campaign Committee chair, warming up to Jim Jordan. No. I really don't see it. Because that's too much about money and power and how many establishment guys we can get into positions of influence. So I don't see that happening. But again, I think the Ohio Republican Party and Chairwoman Jane Timken missed a great opportunity to try to solidify the Republican base. And I think committed a horrible faux pas.
Yeah.
I think it's just horrible.
Yep. Well, but it is typical of the Ohio Republican Party establishment. There were a lot of people that thought things were going to change when Jane Timken got in, and unfortunately, they went from a Kasich-controlled party to a Husted-controlled party. So,
right.
Essentially, what did we get? We basically took the wallet out of our left-hand pocket and put it in our right-hand pocket. The wallet's still back there. And, it's going to make very little difference. Kasich's is essentially basically brooming himself out of further political office. But John Husted is already sort of laying the groundwork to run for Senate. So that's kind of the bottom line. The real question is that if Mike DeWine wins in November, and that's a real question, if DeWine Husted gets in, then, we were just talking about this yesterday. How old is Mike DeWine? Did we ever figure that out? He's like 74, isn't he?
I'm going to look it up real quick because, yeah, I think it's like in the 74 or
yeah,
so.
We're winding down to the last couple minutes. But the fact is that in 4 years, that would make him 78. And at the end of his 4-year term, would make him 79, which would make him 83 at the end of a second term. Do you think Mike DeWine's going to run for a second term? The answer is no.
He's 71.
Oh, 71. Okay.
Yep.
So he'll take office.
He'll be 72 before he's sworn in in January, should he win.
That makes him 76 and 80 at the end of a second term. He's not going to run for a second term.
Yep. I doubt very seriously.
Yeah. So that's the kind of triangulating you really have to do in this game. I'm not sure exactly why Mike DeWine decided he needed to be governor, except there were other Republicans who didn't think they could get the job done, but they knew they could run for it from second place. And unfortunately, it looks like it's too bad that Mary Taylor didn't win that primary. Like, really, really, really too bad that Mary Taylor didn't win that primary. But she didn't win. So that's the bottom line. And the bottom line here is we're out of time.
As usual.
As we always are. Especially when we get into the middle of an interesting discussion. Well, that being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.